Good afternoon, everyone. The Senate Capital Investment Committee will come to order. It's February 11th at 3 p.m., 2025. And I think we have a quorum. Some people are joining us online. And so the first thing on our agenda is I'd like to welcome Major General Sean Mankey, Adjutant General, and Don Kerr, Executive Director, the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. Welcome. And go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for letting us come and address the committee today. It's my pleasure to be the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, representing the nearly 13,000 citizen soldiers and airmen of your National Guard. So we're here today to talk about the 148th Fighter Wing Aircraft Hangar. Currently, the governor recommends $3 million to design the new Universal Fighter Aircraft Hangar. The Luth 148th Fighter Wing flies the latest version F-16 Block 50 fighter aircraft for the Air National Guard and the U.S. Air Force. The current structure that houses those aircraft on the flight line was built nearly 70 years ago when there was a Duluth Air Force Base. In the 1980s, this structure was moved from where the Duluth Air Force Base was on the other side of the airfield over to where it currently sits on the 148th portion of the airfield. This hangar was not purpose-built for the aircraft that it houses today or for future aircraft that the 148th, we hope to see the 148th in someday. So the purpose is really we're asking for $3 million of design money, at which point if the hangars are designed with state money, then we can more effectively compete those for the $28 million estimated for the construction of those hangars in Duluth. As you know, the Duluth, we can go to the next slide here, please. Here's a picture of the existing hangars, and you can see that these facilities are a little dated. They leak a little, so there's some safety hazards with them, but we are effectively using them to do what we need to do, but of course something needs to be done in the future to sustain this mission. One of my priorities is two flying missions for the Air National Guard of Minnesota. We have the C-130 unit in Minneapolis-St. Paul, which has been selected to receive C-130J models, which will guarantee them a flying mission for approximately at least the next 25 years. And while the Luth flies the latest version of the F-16s, we are looking for the next generation aircraft for them to maintain a flying mission for them. And these are two of the aircraft right now that the Air Force and the Air National Guard fly, the modern ones, the F-15EX and the F-35 fighter. Next slide. So this is what the hangar aircraft would look like. Three bay shelter design that would fit both the F-15EX, F-35, or perhaps the next generation future fighter for the United States Air Force. And that's the timeline. We expect design 12 to 15 months and then construction from 18 to 24 months after that. And so you may ask yourself, why would we use state money to fund a hangar in Duluth? The state commitment would likely influence our success in getting federal funding as a follow-on to build these facilities. As I said, two flying wings in Minnesota, I think, is instrumental to the success of the Minnesota Air National Guard. The 148th Fighter Wing in Duluth is their seventh largest employer. And additionally, along with the wing comes a lot of other support services that the community and the state of Minnesota directly benefit from. One is a firefighting capability, and they provide all of the firefighting resources for the Duluth International Airport, estimated about $3.6 million a year of federal money that is used to support that firefighting effort, as well as they respond to community fires if the local authorities are overwhelmed. As well as the other thing is there's other things like we have an explosives ordnance disposal unit in Duluth that has been called upon when other state resources have been tied up doing other things when they need to respond if needed. And then we also use these for the federal mission, but also we have a fatality search and rescue team that was used in the state active duty mission responding through the Emergency Mutual Aid Compact where they went down to Florida and searched for people who perished in that, as well as going to North Carolina. So that's the so what a why we think the 148 should remain in Minnesota. Next slide, please. And Madam Chair, pending any questions from the committee, that's all I have for you today.
General Menke, under kind of normal circumstances, when you apply for money from the federal government, how much would they, what would you estimate they would provide?
So we would ask for the full $28 million for the construction of those facilities.
And is that typically what is awarded?
In this particular instance, it would, because it's on a federal installation and it's a federal facility.
All right, fantastic. So just having the gesture of the state supports it with the design money would really move that forward.
Yeah, it would move it forward, and it would show the state's commitment to the organization, the state of Minnesota. And the Duluth, the 148th Fighter Unit competes very well. I mean, the organization is well manned. They're at 103% strength. Their maintenance is very good, and they have responded to numerous federal calls for service.
Could you clarify again that the property is federally owned?
I think the Duluth Air Base piece of it is on federal property.
Executive Director Kerr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, for the record. The actual plot of land that we're planning to put the hangars on does belong to the state of Minnesota. We did research that thoroughly, but good catch on Council's part.
Well, I had a bird who whispered in my ear over here about, you know, not being able to do a bonding project on federally owned land.
Right.
Yeah, so that's good. That's good. Any other, any questions from, yes, Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You kind of went down a path that I had a question on, and I just want to clarify. So, Executive Director, it sounds like part of the property is owned by the feds, part of the property is owned by the state, and where we want to put this hangar happens to be a parcel that's owned by the state. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator.
Executive Director Kerr. Sure. Thank you.
And then,
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for being here, General. If I understood, you said the full $28 million for the project could come from the feds. So can you help me understand the $13 million request and how that would work? With the expected federal funding, could we do less? How does that show good faith from the state?
So the $3 million will be for design funding to design the project, and then the once the design is complete, we can more competitively compete it for federal funding for the $28 million.
I think, Senator Pratt, I thought you said $13 million, but
it's
$3
million. I'm sorry, if I said
13. No, I think Senator Pratt, I heard him say $13 million. So I think it's three. No, it's $3 million for design.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions from members of the committee? Then thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your service. Next we have John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Senator Housley is joining us on Zoom, so I think keep our eyes out if she does have any questions, so we can be sure to call on her.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, that's it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here to walk through the agency's capital budget requests for 2025. So the mission of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is to serve Minnesota veterans, their dependents, and survivors by connecting them with the federal and state care and benefits that they have earned. We run the Minnesota State Veterans Homes and assist Minnesota's nearly 300,000 veterans and their dependents in securing valuable benefits and services. We have veterans homes across Minnesota as well as state cemeteries. We have four state cemeteries and we have authorization for a fifth state cemetery. We also have our offices in the Veterans Service Building as well as the federal Whipple Building and in the Fargo claims office. This slide shows the administration's approach to asset preservation. We want to have strong investments to significantly reduce future costs, avoid negative impacts to service delivery for Minnesotans, and administer asset preservation programs promptly, efficiently, and transparently. We have asset preservation priorities here on the next slide. I will get here to agency-wide asset preservation. As you can see on the slide, 71 buildings across the state with a replacement value of $496 million, and 12 of our buildings have a 24/7 occupancy. Renovations and upgrades to these buildings will address building repair items that go beyond the day-to-day maintenance and needs of each facility and ensure the facilities are used to care for our 900-plus residents are in good condition. So the first slide for our requests in the governor's capital budget for 2025 is So we have an $11.94 million asset preservation request. I'm just going to pause here. Got that wrong deck up. Apologies.
That's good, because we were about to start telling jokes.
Yeah, no, I apologize about that. We have $11.94 million for asset preservation improvements and betterments of the capital nature in our state veterans cemeteries in Preston and Little Falls, as well as Minneapolis, Hastings, Fergus Falls, Silver Bay, and Laverne. These requests would be used to renovate and replace components and agency-managed buildings throughout the state. We have everything on our list, you know, for asset preservation from $158,000 in Minneapolis to deal with issues around our plaster walls to $1.5 million in plumbing for single-user restrooms, which is a priority for our veterans in Silver Bay. So we have, you know, issues larger and smaller throughout our asset preservation ask. This request would, you know, help us address these critical needs across the footprint across our state veterans' homes and cemeteries. Examples of projects in this request include roofs, chillers, boilers, tuck pointing, elevator repairs, window and door replacement, mechanical and other electrical replacements. This is really critical for us. We have a lot of homes and buildings across the state, but most of this funding is going to target historical structures still in daily use at the Minnesota Veterans Home, which is over 100 years old. The agency currently has more than $116 million in deferred maintenance, with approximately $56.8 million in that FCI rated as crisis or poor. And then the second ask for the department, we have $17.404 million for a complete redesign and fund of the remodeling of Building 16 on the Minnesota Veterans Home Minneapolis campus. This is part of the department's domiciliary program. It is a residential building on the campus and is staffed and occupied 24/7. This ask is for the full cost to fund the remodeling of Building 16. We also will potentially be able to request reimbursement from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for this project. This building has major HVAC issues. It's experienced periodic failures and is nearing the expected use of its useful life. During the project evaluation process, many other building systems were identified as nearing or past their useful lives and in need of replacement. Other examples include plumbing issues, such as you see on this slide, it's a little hard to tell, but we've had some issues with the wastewater lines in the building as well. Our deputy commissioner, to give you an example, came in one day. He likes to come in for healthcare. He's based in his office is in Minneapolis, and he came in to get coffee in Building 16 and meet with the veterans. And he looked around and noticed that they were all wearing ski caps. The temperature had dropped to 55 degrees, and we got maintenance in and got it sorted out. But it's, again, it's an ongoing effort to heat and cool this very critical building on the Minneapolis campus, and we're looking to really get that HVAC system renovated and deal with the other issues with the building. And with that, I will pause for questions.
Mr. Kelly, how much is just the design portion of the remodel?
I can find out. I don't have that right in front of me.
Is the full $17 million in the governor's budget?
Yes.
So you mentioned that you could potentially get reimbursement from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So how does that work? If we borrow the money to do the building, then how does the reimbursement then for that work?
Madam Chair, members, I believe that the we would potentially be reimbursed for a portion of the cost of the of this renovation, but I don't think it would cover the potentially the entire cost. But I can get more. But we request reimbursement. We are currently requesting reimbursement for capital projects for the three new homes as well. So we request reimbursement from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and they reimburse the department.
Have you gotten reimbursement from the other veterans' homes?
We're still waiting on the last tranche of reimbursement funding for the three new veterans' homes.
So does our staff, have you ever heard of this? Do you know how that works?
Yeah. So Madam Chair, there's a portion of the funds that the, you know, Capital Investment Committee or the, you know, the legislature puts up, and then there's a matching portion from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
I understand the matching portion. I just don't understand the idea of a reimbursement because, you know, it's bonds we're talking about. It's not cash.
Right.
You know, I can understand if it was a cash reimbursement, but if we're already selling the bonds, then do we get reimbursed so that we pay off the bonds? Or someone is, we asked for a friend. We called up a friend here.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Chair, members, Ben Johnson, Deputy Commissioner, Programs and Services, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So the process by which we would secure additional funding from the feds to offset some of the borrowed funding would be that any amount over $400,000 can be submitted to the VA for a reimbursement to offset those costs for construction like this. The new construction, the visits that you've made to the existing homes that we've completed, we're submitting billing for the construction portion, and the VA is reimbursing those. That's the matching portions. This is for health and safety issues in particular. We would submit this to the VA. I'm not sure about the specific mechanism by which it would be offset from borrowed funding through the bonding process, but the allocation would basically be that the state gives us the portion of funding that we're seeking to do the full reimbursement, the full renovation, and then we would be submitting to the VA, and they would be considered on a case-by-case basis. So there's a process behind the scenes that I basically finance and the Department of Admin and M&B would have their hands on, but the reimbursement is through the state VA's state construction grants program.
Well, that's pretty much what Mr. Kelly said, but I just don't understand how if we're bonding for the full cost, if we're bonding for part of it, I mean, if a local community comes in and they, you know, they agree they're going to pay for part of a project and the state's going to pay for part of a project and we describe what the state's going to pay for, then we sell bonds and there is a reimbursement. There is a reimbursement process then, right? Yeah, can you help a little bit, Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, I think that the bonds, we wouldn't be there, the reimbursement money from the federal government would not be able to be used to like refund the bonds or something like that. It would go into the general fund, so it'd be available to pay debt service on bonds, but you would have used your bonding capacity and target as you put together a spreadsheet for the project.
So it doesn't really help me with my target, in other words. Just goes to the general fund. All right. If you find out anything different, please let us know.
I'd be happy to secure additional information on that actual process and be helpful to your target.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know Senator Dibble asked us to hold off on number four until he came back. He was presenting a bill, but we also have this panel on deferred maintenance, which also includes the Department of Transportation. Do the panel first. All right. Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. And we are very supportive of asset preservation. Okay, so next we have, we're going to skip over the Department of Transportation, and we're going to go to the Agency Panel on Deferred Maintenance, and inviting up Nancy Freeman, Alice Roberts Davis, and Mr. Catterud Hubinger. Those are the three. So this, the whole point of this is to get, try to get more of a handle on our deferred maintenance kind of across the entire system. And so if each of you could kind of introduce yourselves, what agency you represent, and then talk a little bit about your maintenance requests, how much it's growing, how your assets are deteriorating, and if they have an impact on your operating budget. Okay, who wants to go first?
I can go first.
Sure. Nancy, this was your idea. Ms.
It was
Freeman.
My idea.
Chair Pappas, would you like us to answer each of those questions sequentially or all at the same time?
I think all at the same time is fine. They probably overlap.
And you might have to refresh my memory, too, as I'm talking.
Oh, I thought you got them in advance. I'm so sorry.
I didn't.
All right. Just go ahead with whatever you were going to talk about. And then if you don't cover something, we'll ask questions.
Okay, perfect. My name is Nancy Freeman, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer from Direct Care and Treatment.
Can you be a little closer to the mic?
I'm sorry. My name is Nancy Freeman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer from Direct Care and Treatment with the Department of Human Services. And I oversee all of the facilities for Direct Care and Treatment. We have approximately a little over 200 sites. We own 185 buildings across the state of Minnesota. There's over 3 million square feet in all of those buildings. Our current replacement value is a little over $1 billion. And our deferred maintenance as of September 1st was a little over $183 million. We have requested this year in the governor's recommended bonding is $11.43 million in asset preservation and then other projects besides that. We have seen over the last several years that even with about $8 to $10 million, our deferred maintenance is still going up. And so it's hovering right around that $170 to $180 million consistently over the last several years. In 23, we did receive bonding for asset preservation of $7.2 million in bonds and then $2 million in the cash asset preservation that was appropriated from the legislature.
Can you say that again? How much was that in 23?
$7.2 million in bonds and $2 million in cash.
In terms of how your assets are deteriorating and kind of what state they're in, you know, would you grade them, you know, adequate or fair or poor or...
All of them have different, because our buildings are so big, just down at St. Peter, for those of you who have been there, there's over a million square feet, and just in the what we previously called the security hospital, it's that in itself is 700,000 square feet. So it's kind of hard to say by building. There's sections and portions or components of the building that are bad, but in buildings so big, when they're a component is bad, the dollar amount is bad to fix it. So if that kind of makes sense. So it's hard to say X building is in crisis and this, there's portions of the buildings all around DCT, with the exception of our group homes that are just like a regular house.
Right.
So we have probably of the 75 group homes that we own, there's probably about 15 to 20 of them that are in poor or crisis situation.
Are you having to use some of your operating budget then to fill in on some of these deferred maintenance needs?
We do. And some of our problems that we have, I always keep a little bit of the asset preservation money a set aside in case there is an emergency situation if we don't have enough operating dollars to do it. So, yes, we do use a lot of operating dollars when we need to, especially if there's an emergency situation.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for, yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize, I had another meeting, so I missed part of the presentation, but I did hear you speak about the large vastness of the assets and the buildings that need attention. And I have toured St. Peter before, but I guess my question is, who looks at the fact that maybe we don't need that much space? Maybe a smaller footprint is needed, and we could take care of it better. And if we look at the rest of the world, well, maybe except for the state capitol grounds here, typically we're seeing less and less space needed to continue whatever services are taking place there. And I'm just curious, this might not be just specifically to your presentation, but I think it's a topic that I think we should look at, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on continuing the high cost of preserving space that may be in excess of what would be most necessary or most effective today.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Senator. We annually go through what we call a space allocation, and we look at how space is being used. And so we do look at what I call fluffy space that isn't being used appropriately or as efficiently as possible. So yes, we do that. And as you probably know, we have a building down in St. Peter that we're in the process of demolishing because of that purpose. It was not cost effective to remodel and refurbish that building because of the age and what we needed to do to bring it up to code. So we did choose to demolish that because we didn't need the space. And we also have our Cambridge site that is on surplus, and that we're looking to demolish those buildings on there, with the exception of the townhomes at Cambridge. So yes, we do that.
Thank you. I just think that's an important discussion for us to keep in mind as we move forward, especially in this committee. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent question, Senator Nelson. Absolutely. Senator Johnson-Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick follow-up. Just want people to know that removal of assets is a huge problem for property owners as well as for just facility owners. That I just met with the school board or superintendent for one of my school districts. They have a similar problem. They have a building that's no longer functional, but they can't afford to fix it up, and they can't afford to tear it down. So I think that's a great question, Senator Nelson. And I think it's also important for us to remember that maintaining and enhancing facilities is expensive, but so is getting rid of them. So thank you for your continued work, and I appreciate that expense as well.
Yeah, we took down the Ford building on University Avenue, the Ford, it was a car building factory, and you were the commissioner then, Ms. Roberts Davis. I believe it was like $1 million to take it down.
I think it was more than that. At the time we were looking at it, I believe it was about between $2 and $4 million for demolition of that building.
To just take it down.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Senator Ann Johnson-Stewart.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, the other issue for us to remember as the bonding committee is sometimes when these buildings or bridges or treatment plants are removed, they also contain materials that make it extremely expensive to eradicate and to restore the site. So it's a lot of work. I thought of that a lot with the dam down by Mankato. That is going to be a huge project to figure out how to get it back to a functional site. So again, thank you for your good work.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the testifiers. Does the governor's proposal increase capacity at any DCT facilities?
Ms. Freeman.
In the governor's recommended budget, there is no increased capacity at DCT sites.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, one of the concerns that I have, and I think a lot of folks across the state have, especially at the county level and county attorneys, county sheriff's offices, is with the waiting list at direct care and treatment, especially in a number of the facilities, whether it be at facilities in St. Peter or in Anoka. Madam Chair, you, the committee might be familiar with something that's called the 48-hour rule, where individuals who, you know, have been deemed to be civilly committed to the state are supposed to be become wards of direct care and treatment. And just to give you an example, I had a constituent who was in a jail for 100 days waiting to get a bed at direct care and treatment, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who's been deemed as should be civilly committed, should not be in a jail setting, should be in a healthcare setting, but was waiting in a jail because there wasn't a facility. And so I think it's important whether we look at the capital investment budget for direct care and treatment or the operating budget for direct care and treatment, we have to figure out how to get more capacity for Minnesotans who are in need, because it's creating a lot of issues for those individuals in their care. It's creating issues in our jails, our hospitals, and throughout the entire system. And I'm disappointed that the governor, in his budget, both on the capital investment side and frankly on the operating side and the Human Services Committee, really hasn't put forward any plan to get into compliance with the 48-hour rule. And I think, unfortunately, we see that with the proposal here today.
And Ms. Freeman, are you aware of any plan to increase capacity for these comments?
Yes, I am aware of we've been putting together some different reports, but we could take that offline unless you want to discuss that today.
No, I think it's fine. I not to discuss it today, but certainly have a discussion with Senator Rasmussen about it. Yeah. All right, thank you. If no more questions for Ms. Freeman, then we're gonna move on to Ms. Roberts Davis, welcome back. And I think we haven't had the university in officially yet. We're just talking about deferred maintenance here.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. Yeah. We will be here on the 18th. We're looking forward to that. So thank you, Chair Pappas and members, for the invitation to be here today. I'm Alice Roberts Davis. I'm Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota. And it's our pleasure to talk with you about our deferred maintenance concerns. First, I'll just say, as Minnesotans, we are very fortunate to have a world-renowned research institution right here in our backyard. Our most recent economic impact report shows that the university contributes $11.5 billion to the economy of Minnesota, and so we can't take that for granted, and there is a real risk in not reinvesting in the
Is that every
plans.
Year?
That is correct.
Thank
That's
you.
Correct. So the University of Minnesota is comprised of 30 million square feet of building space. That's more than 900 buildings. We are spanning across 5 campuses, a dozen research and outreach centers across the state, and our facility portfolio is valued at over $15 billion. Unfortunately, more than 50% of our buildings are over 50 years old. Mm-hmm. Almost 9 million square feet, or a third of our space, is in poor or critical condition. Our current 10-year facility renewal need is right at $6 billion. This is the total of costs for window replacements and roof replacements, heating and cooling upgrades, disability access, and building code projects that should have already been done, but we know that they have to be done in the near future, if not sooner. This is kind of like your home. You can delay replacing your furnace or fixing your windows for a while, but if you want to keep living in that house, eventually you have to put money into it, and the longer you wait, the more expensive it becomes. So as a public entity, we rely on the state heavily to be a major partner in keeping our university facilities safe, reliable, and up to date. And our infrastructure and facility investments are long-term investments that we have to make investments in for the future of Minnesota. In partnership with the state, we should be investing about $200 million into facility projects every year just to maintain the status quo. That means that not more than that one-third would fall into poor or critical condition with a $200 million a year investment. So really, we're talking about a much greater investment than that to start to decrease the backlog. We recognize that $200 million in HEPR, which is what we've requested from the state this year, is a lot of money, but deferred renewal is a national problem. This is not just the University of Minnesota. The state has the same issue with deferred backlog, and all of our public assets and infrastructure have to be reinvested in. We've been facing headwinds with state priorities that have been shifting over the last decade, where we're seeing both irregular bonding bills and bills that are less predictable. We've only received HEPA funding in 4 of the last 10 years, as well as smaller percentages of the bonding bill have been going to higher education and state agencies. Higher education was historically the largest receiver of state bond funding. Back in 1990-ish, when HEPA was established, we would receive about 50% of the bonding bill. Today, we are about 10% of bonding bills, and we are sharing that with Minnesota State. So really only about 5% of bonding goes toward our higher education and asset preservation needs. For every year of delay, projects become more and more expensive due to time and inflation, and it's really staggering what a dollar buys today versus what it bought 20 years ago when we were investing higher in buildings. We have experienced extraordinary construction escalation during the pandemic, and there have been periods of double-digit cost increases over that time. Of course, it's much less expensive for us to thoughtfully plan and address these issues instead of waiting for emergencies to occur, but we end up in a position where we are often dealing with emergency situations. The industry metric that we use says that $1 in stewardship avoids $3 in future capital renewal. So $100 million HEPA investment would save the university and the state approximately $300 million over time. You asked about how we could better be equipped at the university if we made these investments, and I think that it's important for us to think of this not only as the physical plant, but it's also our recruitment and retention tool for the state of Minnesota. We have to understand that students need and expect to work and learn in the facilities that will reflect the settings where they'll be after graduation. They're looking for settings that will mimic the equipment and the facilities that will have them prepared for the workforce. And if we aren't able to provide that, then we aren't able to recruit the best faculty and students to the university. What we find is that when students choose other schools with superior facilities, obviously our enrollment declines and our state's future workforce could suffer. Once a student leaves the state for college, we find that it's not very likely that they return because they often find relationships or jobs or internships in other states that hold them there for the long term. And so we're really concerned about how this is a long-term effect on our state. I wanted to share with you an example of our HEPA request for the Food Science and Nutrition Building, which some of you have visited in the past. It's a 1956 facility that is home to a nationally recognized food science and nutrition department. We have more than 20 faculty, 125 graduate students, and 500 undergrads, and the program is an absolute gem. It has so much potential, but it leaves so much to be desired. Students come for the hands-on learning and the lab work and product development and the real-world applications, but the spaces are so outdated that we can't do the work. We can't install the latest industry equipment. We even have grants or companies that want to donate equipment to us, and because of the electrical loads in the building, we can't accept those donations. And so it's really unfortunate that we continue to lose ground to at least 3 other universities in close proximity who have brand-new food science nutrition buildings and who become competition to both our university and to our future workforce. And so it's really hard to make choices, as you mentioned, about vacating facilities or continuing to fund them. But I think that at this point in time, we're working on space consolidation projects across the university, as well as how do we best reinvest in those properties that will support our future workforce and will help the university achieve its mission.
Center question, Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the testifier. What percentage of HEPA dollars find their way to the University of Minnesota Morris campus?
Ms. Roberts-Davis.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe it's 2% of the funding goes to Morris. We use an equation that factors in the condition of the buildings as well as the age of the buildings, and that's how we distribute it across the campuses. It's also possible that if there's a major project that they'd want to undertake and it is higher than that we would redistribute the funding.
Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up question. Do you know which of the campuses for the University of Minnesota has kind of the oldest buildings or would get kind of the worst score in terms of that?
Mr. Roberts-Davis.
Chair Pappas and Senator, the St. Paul campus needs large reinvestment, and then second behind that would be the Morris campus.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testifier. I just wanted to, you know, so even if there was a, $100 million or $200 million allocation to the University of Minnesota for HEPR, the University of Minnesota Morris would get just 2% of that, and that, I think, makes it really challenging for them to do any projects of any magnitude. And so that's something I'd like to see the university look to reconsider. If it's going to be one of our campuses and we care about it, we want to make sure their facilities are up to date to not just give them 2% of the overall pie. So that'd be one thing I'd ask the university to take a look at and consider.
It's a great campus. Senator Roberts Davis.
Chair Pappas, Senator, we have just two projects that have been proposed at Morris at this point in time, and one of them has to do with ADA compliance in one of their buildings, and the other one is the library, and we feel like we could very efficiently do either of those projects with a $200 million appropriation.
So it's interesting that you talked about 50% of the bonding bill, because when I was on, I chaired higher ed, we would do a third of a bonding bill would go to higher ed, split between University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. And now you're right, we're down to, in a $790 million bill, which is all I'm allowed, doing $200 million for the university is just not going to be possible. It's just, we have limits on how much we can borrow. So it's concerning to me. How much do you think that you're needing to spend from your operating budget on HEPR projects? Because you're not getting the money you need from the state.
Chair Pappas and members, as you know, our operating budget is also very stressed at this point in time. So generally about $11 million a year goes into renovations and repairs for our campus.
So campus-wide.
For the Twin Cities specifically, a smaller amount for the other campuses. And so about $11 million would go on to our largest campus.
Yeah, that's not very much.
It's not.
Right. Right. Any other questions for Ms. Roberts-Davis? Yes, Senator Johnson-Stewart.
Thank you for your testimony, Madam Chair. I just want to note that I'm feeling really sad for the university right now. You may not know that I've been there either as a student or on staff for 40 years. And I remember the last time I was on bonding committee, we toured Pillsbury Hall, which over the course of my four decades there had been just an eyesore and a really poorly used building, but then thanks to bonding investment, it's just become a gem on campus. Just recently reading the article wherein the new president talked about this loss of funding from the National Institute of Health and the challenges that the university and others are facing from this sudden restriction in federal funds, it just makes me really sad. Like, the University of Minnesota is a shining star, and that's not even an understatement. And Morris is great, Crookston is great, Rochester is great, Duluth is great, and all of our MinSCU programs. And I just am sad thinking about how we just can't, I mean, to your point, Madam Chair, we cannot afford to keep up these buildings, and yet without the university, we can't continue to attract the talent and the research that is making Minnesota the state that I love so much. So I wish there was a way for us to figure this out. I really feel for our chair, because I know her heart's at the university too. And I guess I just want to say that. So thank you for your commitment. I saw what the investment in Pillsbury has done, as well as Northrop and all the other buildings that we've been able to invest in. And while there's not necessarily a hierarchy, I mean, what you're doing is great, what you're doing is great, what MnDOT does is great, I just feel really disappointed that we just don't have as much money as we really need to commit to these buildings. So that's it.
And the child development building turned out really
absolutely.
Well. Can you give us a little update on the chemistry building?
The chemistry building will be open in 2026, I believe. 2025?
This fall,
2025, it's opening in 2025, and we will serve 6,000 students each year in chemistry classes there, and it is absolutely lovely. We worked with the Minneapolis Park Board in order to retain those beautiful views of the Mississippi River from the building, and we're very excited and we're thankful for the funding that made that building
and
possible.
And we'll make a bonding tour to the grand opening.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Please do.
We have to do
Please
that.
Do.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Dibble is back in the room. Great. So next we'll move on to Josh. Is it Natarud Hubinger?
Very close.
Very close. Thank Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Transportation, to tell us about their asset preservation woes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I do wonder, it might be instructive if I just go through my presentation from the previous agenda topic. I directly addressed this issue as well, or do you want to kind of stick with the panel format?
No. You go through your presentation. That's fine. On the topic. Right.
All right. Bear with me for just a moment.
And this is different, though, from, is this going to be your presentation that was on the agenda earlier?
It is, but I can go through it very quickly.
Yeah, no, that's fine. You can combine the two. That's fine.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Josh Knetter-Hubinger, CFO at MnDOT. Going to cover two topics today, the bonding items in the governor's budget, as well as a request from the Senate Transportation Committee from a previous hearing about how trunk highway bonding interacts with general obligation bonding more broadly. So just to set the stage a little bit for MnDOT, we are large, we are multimodal, we have the fourth largest roadway system in the country, over 143,000 centerline miles on the trunk highway system and local roads combined, 7 active ports. We oversee Greater Minnesota Transit, so 34 transit providers serving all 80 outstate counties, over 130 airports, 4,500 plus miles of railroads. So when we're talking about bonding requests, we have to consider all of those modes together. In terms of what's in the governor's budget this year, there are two items. So I'll go through these very quickly. There is $1.8 million in general obligation bonds for highway railroad crossing warning devices. So these are those devices you see as you cross the railroad where it intersects with a highway.
I just want to stop for a minute since we've kind of reverted back to your presentation. We're going to blend the two. Maybe if there's no more questions for Ms. Freeman and Ms. Roberts-Davis from the committee, then I think we can excuse you. You don't have to sit up there. Thank you. And we'll see you, Ms. Roberts-Davis, next week. I'm sorry. Continue, Mr. Hubinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Apologies for holding my panel members hostage for a moment there. So again, $1.8 million in general obligation bonds for warning devices at railroad crossings. Each device costs somewhere around $400,000, so we're talking about 4 to 5 crossings that would be addressed with this proposal. We did receive $3.6 million in general obligation bonds in 2023. In the most recent round of funding, there are 750 systems that are out of normal life cycle. That's out of a total of around 4,000 across the state. We've made some really good progress in terms of fatalities and incidents at those crossings, but there's always more to be done. We've gotten signalized systems at about a third of all of the crossings across the state, but again, a lot more needs than there is funding. So again, 4 to 5 individual crossings would be addressed with this proposal.
Could I stop just for a minute to ask the what are the number of requests dollar-wise?
So Madam Chair, this request is $1.8 million in GO bonds.
No, that's what the governor's recommending. But what is the number of, in terms of your requests, how high is that?
So if you were to fund all of our needs for those 750 systems out of life cycle, that would be $300 million. That's not our ask any given year. The goal would be somewhere around $30 million to address kind of that next round that's in the worst shape.
Okay.
But the total out of date is somewhere around $300 million.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I will move on to the one other request in the governor's budget. It's for $2.8 million in GO bonds for the ports. We have a Port Development Assistance Program, or shorthand called PDAP. I believe there was a letter in the materials from the Ports Association documenting their request of $44 million. And so this would buy down that $44 million ask from the ports. Again, there's 7 ports across the state, 5 public ports. We did receive some sizable amounts in the 2 of the larger, most recent bonding bills, $14 million in 2020, $18 million in 2023. And that is basically it for what's in the governor's budget. I do have a couple other slides to give some context for why maybe there are so few transportation-related requests this year, mm-hmm. and then also directly addressing the request from the Transportation Committee from our week or so ago. So just for context, there was a lot of money for transportation in the large 2023 capital funding bills, about $400 million for basically the modes and the local systems. Those are listed on the left. I won't go through those one by one. We also received about $600 million in trunk highway bonding for 4 kind of discrete areas, $200 million for state road construction. That was the remaining funding gap on the Blatnick Bridge. $153 million for Quarters of Commerce. That's a program that's received well north of $1 billion over the last 10 years. MnDOT Facilities received $87 million, and then some specific projects received $158 million. Wow. So then kind of tying the general obligation bonds to MnDOT's trunk highway bond requests, there's a lot of overlap. We have 6 internal financial policies that help us decide how much to ask for and what type of funding to request. I'm just going to focus on the trunk highway and how trunk highway bonds overlap with general obligation bonds.
Before you go into that new topic, so I just wanted to note, so the governor is not recommending any local road or local bridge dollars this year in the bonding bill.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And that's correct.
You'll note in 2023, the local road improvement program, which quite regularly receives general obligation bonds, received $85 million, mm-hmm. and the local bridge replacement program received $67 million.
And do you know if those dollars have been used up and dispersed, and are there more requests?
Madam Chair, yes. So those solicitations have happened. The requests well exceeded those dollar amounts by mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead then. Continue.
So I will spend a little time on this slide. So trunk highway bonding is something that MnDOT has utilized quite a bit, especially since 2008. So that was when there was a large funding package after the bridge collapsed on 35W. Mm-hmm. It included $1.8 billion in trunk highway bonds. Since then, it's become a very large part of how we fund our trunk highway projects. So in the last 10 years, it's been about $2.7 billion of trunk highway bonds. That's been about a third of all of the bonding over that same time period. So typically, and that's consistent over the last 20 years as well. Trunk highway bonds are largely the same as general obligation bonds, except that the trunk highway fund repays the debt. So the costs that go with these bonds are repaid from the trunk highway fund, but in every other way, they're treated like general obligation bonds. So they still count against the enterprise limits for the policies. We have an internal policy, which is on the screen, that is stacked on top of that enterprise limit. So the enterprise limit comes first. So that $790 million target as a state because of guideline 3, our internal policy would say we can afford $630 million in additional trunk highway bonds. That would all count against that 790 as well. So I just want to make that very clear for this committee.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam. When you're done, I'll continue on. I just want to make sure I had my hand up when
okay.
we're done. So
we'll put you on the list.
Perfect. And then the other element that plays into the discussion for transportation funding, there's quite a bit of work done in 2003 for ongoing new revenues to fund the system. It works its way through to actual projects in a slightly different way than in the general fund. So we, right now, in the Trunk Highway Fund, have a very sizable fund balance that will play into funding capital projects through cash. So in the governor's operating budget, there is well over $100 million of trunk highway road construction projects that are funded from our existing fund balance, which right now works its way up to almost $600 million in fiscal year 29. So there's kind of a, most of our requests on the operating side could also be considered capital if you're being a little flexible with the language. And then I will, that's all I had for slides. I will leave one slide up just for context to address the request from the panel. So this is across our different modes, what we would say are kind of the funding gaps or deferred maintenance. across our different modes. So we did just present on a funding gap report that we were required to do at the highway user tax distribution level. We're talking about $1.9 billion of additional needs every single year for the trunk highway system and counties and cities. But with that, happy to answer any questions.
This last slide, I can't quite see it. Is it in the packet?
This is new, so
it's a new slide. We don't have this.
Yes.
Right. So could you just go over it again? These are the funding gaps.
Correct. So there is a legislative report that goes into a lot more detail on those first three bullets. So between the trunk highway system, counties, and cities, this is for roads and bridges, there's a $1.9 billion funding gap per year.
This is the deferred maintenance?
Yes.
Okay.
And then for MnDOT facilities, specifically for what we own almost 900 buildings across the state, largely related to our operations and maintenance. $1.53 billion total replacement value, about $215 million in deferred maintenance on our actual facilities. And then for the two requests that are in the governor's budget, I did put in the kind of estimated gap for those two areas as well. So $44 million for ports, $300 million for grade crossing.
So I would like to have this as well. If you could send it to us digitally, it's fine. And then Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think you're going to get some voices from this side of the table just looking at my neighbors here. And again, I think it's continuing off on your intro is, again, very frustrated the governor doesn't have LRIP. And last year we did not see it. This year we're not seeing it. In the original report that was in our packet, we were facing an $890 million a year in funding gap each year. So LRIP and Local Bridge Replacement Program also has that. So again, all these things are getting worse and worse because the governor's not putting them in his budget for LRIP and local bridge replacement. And this is just gonna get worse. We've had many discussions on if you don't fix these things, they're gonna get worse and worse. And I was surprised last year the governor didn't have it in his budget. And now again, this year, again, I realize that there was new money has been done through the transportation advancement account and new fees and new taxes and things like that. But we're getting behind in our roads and bridges, and I brought it up before. We're looking at funding a state patrol headquarters out of trunk highway funds, which should not be coming out of there. I have been very vocal on that. I think many other people feel that. Whether they can say it or not, I don't know. But I definitely agree we need a state patrol headquarters, but we should not be using money for our roads and bridges with an $890 million gap each year. So that's my frustration. I think some numbers that I saw, $103 million was available last year for the LRIP program, but only 86 projects got used for that. And there was actually 378 applications with $417 million in needs. So again, I don't know if this is the governor's choice or recommendations by staff, but for 2 years in a row for the governor to ignore roads and bridges in Minnesota, given what we have with the fourth largest number in the state, we have frost and thaw issues here, so it's so important to continue to reinvest in that, and we're seeing it diminishing over the cycle I've seen for the last 2 years. We're not getting that funding for roads. And again, I'm just going to say my frustration with the governor of not putting money towards roads and bridges. This is frustrating for myself, and I think many Minnesotans have the same issue, and maybe many people behind the desk here do as well. But I'm frustrated with that. I'll let the rest of my other members discuss this, but this is concerning to me, to say the least. So thank you.
So, Mr. Nadler-Hubinger, you don't have to respond to that. I think that was Senator Jasinski's very, very strong opinion. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a kind of a technical question, which may or may not have an answer. So I'm looking at the trunk highway debt management, that shows the additional bonding capacity with the 20% debt management policy. So I'm going down to the third bullet point. Since 2008, we've authorized $4.5 billion in trunk highway bonding, and $1.23 is authorized but unissued. I remember, Madam Chair, when we were receiving the presentation from Minnesota Management in budget, are surprised that our total bonding capacity had gone down from last year. And the, part of the explanation was that more bonds were sold that were already authorized were sold than anticipated this last summer. And so that had a depressive effect on what we thought we were coming into this year.
Right, because we had more
third guideline or not, I don't necessarily want to get into that whole discussion right now. Awesome. I'm wondering if this 1.23 authorized but unissued, if it were, if those bonds were sold, if it would have that same depressive effect that is unanticipated on our overall bonding capacity, GO, trunk highway combined.
Is that a question that you can answer, Mr. Natarud-Hubinger?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I would hazard a guess, but I would want to get the correct answer, so I'll get, confirm that. But I would believe if more bonds were sold now, that would free up more capacity for guideline three.
Did you want to direct that to someone from MMB, Senator Dibble?
Would someone from MMB be poised to, you know, be, so, Madam Chair, Mr. Natarud-Hubinger gets my point, which was, you know, if in fact, you know, those already authorized GO bonds were sold, do you think it would then create more capacity? But it turned out to have the opposite effect, right. Yeah, which was a kind of a surprise. You know, I would love to unpack the whole why do trunk highway bonds impact our GO bonding program, but I don't want to get into that because we've...
All of our debt is put together.
I know.
Yeah.
Which it didn't used to be. Now right. It is. So, see, Margaret Donahoe is like, she wants to spring to the table and say, yeah. All right. I did want to just also express my support for local road improvement program, local bridge replacement program dollars that would be either GO cash or GO bonding. The $890 million in gap is just for the Trunk Highway Fund program. We see on the slide that Mr. Natarud-Hubinger left with us, if you throw trunk highway bridges in there, that's a $1.1 billion per year gap. Despite all of our great efforts in the 2023 bill, the local roads and all that's reflected on his slide is county state aid highway, municipal state aid streets, not the county system that's not on the CASA system,
right.
The municipal roads that are not on MSA system, as well as for smaller cities, and I don't think townships are even mentioned in here. So we're looking at $1 billion in gap for trunk highways. CASA and MSA alone are 600 and 200. You factor in all the other, and keep in mind, local roads constitute about 80% or more of the mileage in the state. Mm-hmm. That's supported from property taxes, some help from the state on a one-off basis. Now we have the Transportation Advancement Account, which is a huge leap forward, but that's going to take quite a while to grow. And so we continue need to make efforts to support those local streets. That's, you know, 80% of the mileage is, you know, only 20% of the vehicle miles traveled, but it's every single trip starts and ends with a local road. And of course, when we think of our communities, we're thinking about our local roads, very, very important to the livability and vibrancy, as well as the consequence for our property taxes. I'll just end, Madam Chair, by saying there's a lot of rhetoric about reversing some of the advances that we made in 2023 in terms of the resources we were able to put on the table, which, to be sure, was a significant leap forward, still got a long ways to go. We will just be that much further behind. And if you think Senator Jasinski is giving angry speeches today, if we were to take all those resources off the table, there's a lot of rhetoric flying around the Capitol about reversing of that, you know, I would advise against that because this funding gap slide would just grow even larger. And I would just repeat what Senator Jasinski said, road maintenance issues do not go away. They do not get cheaper. They just get worse and more expensive over time. We have the fourth largest roadway system in the country. That's a lot of roadways to keep up. It's a good thing. I think that's a credit to those who came before us, our mothers and fathers and grandparents invested in the vitality and vibrancy and the economy and in the prosperity of our state. And now it's our opportunity to step up and maintain all of that and pass it on to our generation that follows. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, Senator Ann Johnson-Stewart.
Thank Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of embarrassing myself, I'm wondering, where's the drinking water and wastewater? Is that bonding or is that cash, the public facilities money?
It's bonding.
So the governor doesn't have any appropriation for that?
We haven't had them present before us yet.
Oh, this is just transportation. See, yeah. I embarrass myself, but that's okay. I do have a question about the local road bridge program. So just a little insight for those of the members that are not from the seven-county metro area. This week I met with county engineers from rural districts, and they mentioned the extreme need for the local bridge and road program because, and this is a little bit different angle, but something really important to bring up, not only are there thousands of bridges, hundreds of bridges anyway, that need repair and rehabilitation, but the challenge, especially for those engineers in the greater Minnesota area, is when we don't fund local bridge improvements, those contractors that rely on bridge work stop working on bridges and they move or they change their equipment or they change their focus from bridges to roads, so that when we do start funding local bridges again, there are far less contractors available to bid the work and to do the work. So by kicking the can down the road, not only are we experiencing the increased costs to maintain and redo those bridges because of inflation, but with less contractors able to do the work, we have less competition, and so we have higher prices. So we are getting double whammed. I am really disappointed in the governor. I mean, I can't even believe that this is the only money that's proposed for transportation. I share my concerns with my colleagues on the Transportation Committee, and I'm kind of horrified. But anyway, I think it's important to understand how contractors work and how we're really shooting ourselves in both feet by not funding local roads and bridges. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just so you know, we have three more people on the list, and we do have another item on our agenda. We really want to hear from Moody's that's here. So if we could kind of make our comments quicker and move along. So next, we have Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, my comments will be brief. I think about our former Senator Gary Kubley, who said, everything has been said, but it hasn't been said by me. And I'm not going to repeat it all. But let me just say, I am just left with this massive question. Why the governor, where is the money going? Where is the governor allocating the funds that we typically give to local roads and bridges? That might not exactly be the question for our testifier, but that is the lingering question here. What are the priorities and where's the money? Where's he placing the money that should be going to local roads and bridges? If you have an answer, I would love. Well,
I'm sure that the testifier here doesn't have that answer,
yes.
But Senator Nelson, we can get the spreadsheet.
Yes.
We did have a presentation by MMB of the governor's entire budget, and I have not seen the, and we have with us, of course, to answer that, Ms. Grunewald-Nildner.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Nelson, I can, you know, I have a spreadsheet that I can share with the committee that shows the entire governor's budget, and maybe one thing I can note is that there is $40 million for local projects set aside in the governor's budget, although nothing is identified. That's kind of left to the legislature.
Yeah, we can resend that spreadsheet out. I actually have not seen the governor's actual bill, but we do have the spreadsheet. Next, we do have Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief, take Senator Jasinski up on his challenge to speak up on the state trooper headquarters. I didn't speak up last time because the troopers, they're just looking for those funds from wherever they can get it, and I understand that. But, you know, I also just, that's not the appropriate fund to take those funds from. I live in a community that's very dependent on trunk highway funds, and the needs are some have been addressed and I'm very grateful for it, but the needs are just there. It seems like they're never ending, and so we have to prioritize roads and bridges and protect those trunk highway funds and use them for the purposes that they were designed for, and how the trunk highway bonds affects the GO bonding capacity. That sounds like there's a real story there. I'm new to this committee. Love to learn more about the history of that and what happened in this third guideline and all this stuff. Sounds intriguing. Look forward to being part of that conversation. But more money for roads and bridges. Thank you.
Briefly, Senator Jasinski.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up with Senator Johnson-Stewart. 948 priority bridges for a total cost of $847 million, and we're given zero. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Mr. Natterwood-Hubinger. Appreciate you coming with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so our final presentation, I'd like to invite now Mr. Dan Kowalski. He's online. Oh, we have an online joining us. The Assistant Vice President, U.S. Public Finance Group, Moody's Investor Services. And welcome, Mr. Kowalski. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I just want to do a quick mic check. Can you all hear me?
You're a little bit muffled.
Okay.
You might have to speak a little slower and maybe closer to your mic.
Can you hear me now? No. And what about now?
Okay. Why don't you continue with your presentation? Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me. I'm going to share my screen for the presentation. Okay. My name is Dan Kowalski. I'm representing Moody's Investor Service. We are a rating agency, and I have been rating the state of Minnesota for the last 4 years. Before that, I rated local governments in Minnesota, cities, school districts, and I rate a number of states, mass transit systems, and other local governments across.
Mr. Kowalski, you're still a little muffled. Could you just speak a little more slowly? And then I think we'll be able to hear you better.
Yeah, sorry about that. All I was saying is that I have been covering the state of Minnesota for the past 4 years on the credit rating of the state, as well as any state-related debt. And before that, led ratings for other local governments in Minnesota, as well as across the country. For some background on credit ratings, this is our assessment of the ability of a state or any organization to be able to repay their debt. AAA is the highest rating, and it goes down from there. The way that we come up with credit ratings is by using methodologies where we score various aspects of an economy, the finances of the state, their debt, pension, and OPEB metrics, as well as their flexibility on the budget and governance. We then use some comparisons to make sure that that rating makes sense across organizations and across the globe. We debate within ourselves as to what the final rating should be, and then we publish reports explaining that rating. Under the state of Minnesota specific information, Minnesota is one of 18 states that Moody's rates at AAA. We upgraded the state's credit rating in, I believe, 2022 on the heels of very strong budgetary balance, as well as low leverage and strong pension contribution practices.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kowalski, could you say those last three things again? Is on what you rated Minnesota? I heard you said something about a budget reserve, but then I didn't hear the other two things.
Yeah, so we had previously rated Minnesota at AA1 and upgraded the state to AAA in 2022. And the rationale for that upgrade was very strong liquidity and budgetary balance or fund balances on an audited basis, stronger pension contribution practices that we'd seen a track record of that, budgets passed on time, as well as overall low leverage from debt, pension, and OPEB liabilities.
What was the last thing?
Liability on pensions? Low leverage from debt, pension, and OPEB liabilities.
The scorecard. It's all pensions, right.
Mm-hmm. Here's the scorecard from last year. This is based on fiscal 2023 information. We have the fiscal 2024 audit, but I wanted to show this for comparison's sake. And you can see that on a lot of these subscores, Minnesota ranks in the AAA category. Now, this scorecard is just an anchor to begin our conversation. This doesn't mean that we are limited by the outcome proposed by the scorecard, but at least begins the conversation for us. You could see that on the income levels, the financial performance, which is a measure of budget and reserves, governance, and leverage, the state comes out at AAA. Diving in a little bit more, I wanted to show you the bands within each subcategory. For the long-term liabilities ratio, which includes debt, adjusted pension liabilities, and adjusted OPEB and other liabilities compared to revenue, the state was around 50% of revenue in leverage, and our AAA cutoff is at 100%. Between 100 and 200%, that subfactor gets you to a AA, and so on. So the leverage is quite strong within the AAA category as well. The other thing I would mention is on the finances. Fund balance on a GAAP basis exceeding 15% of revenue. And this is all on the governmental audited side. So this does not include, say, the universities or other enterprises and component units. The other piece of a AAA finance score is expected structural balance in revenues and expenditures. So we pay close attention to the state's budget. Here are some comparisons. I grab mostly AAA here, but the Midwestern states tend to have a number of different credit ratings. And the median rating across all U.S. states is a AA1. You can see that a common factor here is low leverage, strong available fund balance, strong liquidity. And here we discussed the strengths and challenges of the state from a credit perspective. Again, the ability to pay back debt. I mentioned a few of these things on the strengths, including prudent financial governance practices. And on the challenges, we discussed real GDP and employment growth that was slower than the nation. Things that could make the rating go down: signs of long-term structural budgetary imbalance alongside fund balances forecast to fall below 15% of revenue, large growth in liabilities, sustained economic challenges, or political intractability that could disrupt financial operations or the payment of debt and leases. For the sake of this meeting, I wanted to show you how Minnesota ranks on both leverage and deferred maintenance from our perspective. On leverage, Minnesota has one of the lower leverage ratios overall compared to revenue. And you can see that it's in good company with other AAA rated states. And it's about, the total leverage is about half of what the median state is. And in deferred maintenance, Minnesota, in the way that we calculate it, ranks toward the middle of the pack in terms of the share of capital assets subject to depreciation, or the share of capital assets that have been depreciated. But in this chart, you see that Minnesota ranks toward the bottom of the states where by how quickly that depreciation has accumulated over time. So again, the snapshot, Minnesota's in the middle of states, but when you compare it over a 10-year period, the growth in depreciated assets has been faster than most other states. So that's my presentation. I'm ready to answer any questions, and I hope you guys can hear me with my answers.
So, Mr. Kowalski, let me just see if I understand this. So you do consider deferred maintenance, and you said that Minnesota is about the middle of the pack, but that didn't really impact our AAA rating.
Correct. So deferred maintenance is not a primary methodology factor. It can help us figure out if there are large capital needs on the horizon that maybe is not included in the debt metrics. But it's also that capital depreciation measure is often debated as well. It's part of the reason it's not in our methodology. It's, you know, there are different ways of calculating that number. There are different ways of presenting it in an audit. And so it's kind of a supplementary measure, but it's not a primary measure in our methodology.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of information to assimilate here, but my question was really back on page 4 or slides 7 and 8. Well, the comment that I appreciated that I noted was that our bond rating was upgraded to AAA in 2022. So we do want to rejoice that 2022 we did retain, got back our AAA bond rating. But my question then was on slide 8, and we were looking at the fiscal 2023 scorecard, and my question had to do with under the economy, the last indicator, the economic growth. I noted that was a negative, and that should be concerning to all of us, and I just wondered if our presenter has any description. What happened specifically to Minnesota, perhaps at that time, or what? If there were, do we know about the drop in the economic growth during that time? And also, was that just Minnesota? Was it a function of something that was beyond our state? Maybe still, I don't know, the COVID recovery. I'm not sure, but I'd be interested in why we saw that drop in economic growth in 2023, and this 2023 scorecard.
And Mr. Kowalski, can you answer that question, or do we need someone else?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I can at least provide a little bit of insight. So that negative is compared to the U.S. growth rate over that same time period. So it just means that growth was slower than the U.S. overall on a real GDP basis.
That's concerning.
And the way that it works out is that most states end up in the negative, because certain large states like Texas and Florida kind of suck up some of that GDP growth in the way that we measure it. But it is also in some ways an outcome of population growth, and some other measures.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, just right at the end, I think you said two things. It was compared to U.S. growth, our economic growth was slower, which, of course, I find alarming. And I wanted to know, you mentioned two things. Why was that? What were the factors that that had Minnesota, according to how you measured this, have a slower than average growth in our economy? What were the two factors you mentioned?
Mr. Kowalski.
Yeah, for specific answers, I can follow up with you guys on that. I don't have the information from you right now.
Okay. I would look forward to that. Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kowalski, I missed a little bit of it. Again, your audio is a little muffled. But when you were talking on slide 8 or page 4, you were talking about the budgetary outlook. You mentioned structural balance and something else, and I missed that.
Mr. Kowalski.
Yeah, so I have the description written down on that page with the methodology factors detailed. The two pieces are fund balance over 15% of own source revenue and then structural balance.
Okay. Fund balance over 15%. And you know, as we looked at our current forecast, which shows a $5 billion structural deficit, is that what you're when you're talking structural balance, is that what you're looking at, or that's how we describe the structural balance?
Yeah, we would look at a similar figure. We also look at how the budget is actually passed, so we try not to jump to conclusions before a budget is passed. So we always take those projections with a bit of a grain of salt. We also balance out how high those fund balances are now and how much runway an organization has to reach structural balance.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kowalski, when you're doing these ratings, typically what's the outlook? Are you looking at 20-year bonds, 30-year bonds? I mean, when you rate these things, you're rating them for the life of the bond. Can you give me a sense of what term you're looking at?
Mr. Kowalski.
Yes, that's a great question. We look at all kinds of bonds, whether it's due within 1 year or in 30 years. Our outlook period for our ratings is about 12 to 18 months. And so right now we have a stable outlook on the state. And when we assigned that in May of last year, the idea was that we thought that the credit rating based on that information made sense for another 12 to 18 months.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I have a question while you're thinking about it.
No, I got it.
You got it? Okay.
Mr. Kowalski, could you tell me, do the interest rate forecasts affect your ratings at all?
Mr. Kowalski.
That's a good question. They often do, but not so much for state and local governments. State and local government debt is largely amortizing, and a lot of it is tax exempt. And so interest rates don't end up having as much of an effect.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Kowalski, question for you. Do our debt guidelines reflect what the rating agencies care about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we are agnostic when it comes to debt guidelines. We think that part of good fiscal management is management of liabilities, so strong pension contributions, strong OPEB contributions, and low costs from debt. And so we also use, a total leverage number for that. But how an organization or a state gets to that kind of leverage level, we are agnostic about. You know, how it's split across different programs, whether it's paid, how it's structured. We're more or less agnostic. We just look at the total number and the annual budget impact.
Could you explain what you mean by low leverage to us non-finance people?
Yeah, so I will show this screen again. What we call leverage is basically, the way I think about it is anything that's competing for money against the bondholder, the creditor. And so you have pension liabilities, OPEB liabilities, debt liabilities, lease liabilities, and in the debt liability section, you have all kinds of debt, whether it is appropriation debt, general obligation, state trunk, highway fund debt. And when you add all of that up and compare it to the state's own governmental revenue, that ratio comes out to be pretty far below the average for states, which is a good thing.
Senator Dibble, thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I've asked this question before of other folks, and so I thought I'd ask the expert here who actually knows. So I've been under the impression in the realm of liabilities that a state that fails to keep up its capital infrastructure, its roads and buildings and things like that, is letting those things crumble. That represents a looming potential downside risk in the out years, similar to what we see with HOAs, for example, that don't keep their buildings up and the like. Is that something that the bond houses look at?
Mr. Kowalski.
It is something that we look at. How exactly we calculate it could differ from organization to organization, and what its impact on the leverage factor would be, can be debated as well. So it's something we look at. It's just not one of the primary factors in our methodology.
Senator Ann Johnson-Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want everybody to know we have this PowerPoint, and so it's much easier to see online, FYI. But my question for for you is, if we were to deviate from the policy that we just heard earlier and actually take out more trunk highway bonds, would our bond rating be impacted by that? Would we be downgraded if we took out more trunk highway bonds than mentioned earlier, where we account for them by doing less in general obligation bonds? Do you understand my question?
I think I understand your question, but
Mr. Kowalski.
I apologize. So we as a rating agency are not allowed to provide advice to any organization. And so I can't say what is more beneficial or not. What I can point to is that slide of what could make the rating go down, and it would be large increase in leverage. And, you know, right now Minnesota's leverage ratio is less than half of what the median is for states. So, you know, I can't say how much debt, you know, would lead to a downgrade or a stable outlook or what have you. But all I can say is that the state's total leverage, including debt, is pretty low right now.
Madam Chair, I have a quick follow-up.
Senator Johnson Stewart.
So earlier we heard of the three different guidelines that MMB uses, or I'm sorry, I have so many committees I can't keep them straight. But anyway, we heard about the three different guidelines. Is our bond rating impacted by which guideline we use to set our bonding capacity? That's my question.
I think Senator Johnson Stewart, I think he answered that earlier when he said they're basically agnostic about our guidelines.
Okay, thank you.
And do we have any more questions here? Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question for our testifier. If we were to change our debt guidelines or to break them, to go beyond them, is that something that the rating agency would be concerned about, or it would potentially be a factor that you take into account when you not just look at Minnesota but look at other states? Thank you.
Mr. Kowalski.
No, I don't think that would be a major factor in our credit rating. It's a different situation if there's statutory limits on local governments that, and they breach those, but we really don't apply that analysis to states.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on Senator Johnson Stewart's question, when you're considering debt, are you considering clearly the general obligation bonds? Are you looking at the trunk highway bonds, housing bonds, participation bonds, appropriation bonds like were used to finance the state office building? And quite honestly, the building that we're sitting in right now, or are you just looking at, you know, lease to own? Is all that debt considered, or are you kind of picking and choosing, like, which obligations are included? And is that why it doesn't really matter what source we borrow from, as long as? And I guess my question is coming from, and sorry to keep modifying this, you know, when we talk about the trunk highway fund or the trunk highway fund and the trunk highway bonds, those come from a dedicated tax source.
Mr. Kowalski, my understanding is earlier he answered that question and said all debt, and that it still puts us in the low leverage category. But Mr. Kowalski, is there anything I'm misunderstanding?
Just to clarify, it's all debt on the governmental side, so paid out of the general fund or through dedicated taxes. This is what's not included in this measure is university revenue bonds, certain housing revenue bonds, like HFA revenue bonds. Met Council, for instance, is not included in this measure. Mm-hmm. When you throw everything together, it's still on the lower end.
Did you say are housing infrastructure bonds included or not included?
The ones that are backed by state appropriations are included.
Are included, as well as, yes.
You know, some of the university bonds backed by state appropriations, okay. But not by the revenue bonds for universities and housing are not included.
Okay.
The pension burdens for universities also are not included in that measure.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologies. Maybe I missed this and maybe I should know this, but with the chart you have up there, there's a footnote on Illinois, and kind of Illinois stands out as a real problem there. What's the big factor there in Illinois? What's going on, and can you just comment on that?
Mr. Kowalski. Mr. Kowalski, while you answer that, would Ms. Hassmore come forward from MMB? Because I think we're going to have some questions for you. Mr. Kowalski, is it pensions in Illinois? It's my guess.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't remember what the asterisk is. We might have published this before we got state's most recent audit, and maybe that was the footnote for it. We also have an asterisk for California, but I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, the reason that they're at number one right now is the large of the pension burden.
In California, it's pensions too?
Well, the asterisk here, I think it was because of a delayed audit publishing, but I'm not 100% sure.
Welcome, Ms. Hassamore. Do you have any responses to some of Mr. Kowalski's comments that seem to be a little different than what MMB has presented to us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Jennifer Hassamore, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. I wanted to first start off by thanking Dan Kowalski for sharing the Moody's perspective today. This is a relationship that MMB values greatly, and we have a very strong working relationship with all three of the rating agencies in terms of understanding their methodologies and presenting the state's credit picture to each of them, both when we go into the market to sell bonds every year, as well as keeping them updated on any changes to the state's financial condition throughout the year. We really value being transparent with the rating agencies and keeping them updated on what is happening in Minnesota. So I appreciate Dan coming in outlining the Moody's perspective today. What I would say in response to what you've heard from Moody's today is that there are two other rating agencies in addition to Moody's that MMB regularly seeks credit ratings from. So we are balancing the methodologies from all three of the credit rating agencies that we routinely seek ratings from and are presenting our credit story to each of them in turn every year. One of the factors that I would highlight from the slides here, the one that is up on the screen right now, just to clarify that this low leverage, the way that the rating agencies look at leverage levels, is that it often combines both debt and pensions. And I know that this committee is focused on debt and borrowing levels, but a lot of the rating agency metrics also lump in pension liabilities as well. So just to make that clear and clarify for the committee here. We do, as I testified just a couple weeks ago, take our ongoing adherence to our well-established capital debt guidelines seriously, and believe that those are a good financial management practice that demonstrates long-term financial planning and a commitment to principles of financing our debt. So, again, just want to express the appreciation to the rating agencies for sharing the story, for having the methodology that guides the financial modeling and projections that the state does on debt, as well as financial, economic, and other governance matters. So I'm happy to answer other questions as well.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still looking for the answer to my question about that in looking at the information from our previous testifier, that the compound annual growth rate was the one metric that Minnesota lagged in. And I wonder if you have any documentation, or not documentation, but do we have any insight why that is? I mean, that would be concerning. That's economic growth, and yet we lagged the rest of the nation in that. Why was? Do we have any indication as to why that was?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hassamore.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I don't have the answer to that today. I would want to consult with MMB's economic analysis team that are macroeconomic experts at the state.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I would very much love to hear and get an answer to that, or some ideas about what would make Minnesota less competitive, or why our economic growth would be less than the average. I think that's important. So I look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Any other questions from the members? Then thank you very much. I think it might be interesting for us in our education, because I don't know very much about this topic, if we could invite the other two rating agencies to come in and talk to us as well. So thank you, Ms. Hassemore.
Great, thank you.
And with that, then committee is adjourned.